the last episode, Copenhagen Atomic CTO Asla Stupskart explained the details of their breeder mold nacelle reactor. However, so far we left out on how they started the company, funded operations for the last 6 years, and their unique approach to building reactors while simultaneously dealing with the legal and practical issues of wanting to deal with fissile material. But before that, Asla explains how he got into the topic of nuclear reactors and how he met his co-founders.
While I was studying, I sort of looked at what would I like to spend my time on? What are some of the new exciting fields, science and technology that are going to happen in my lifetime? And I've seen and read about molten salt reactors throughout the years prior. And this was around the time that many of the documents were from the 60s of the program was released. And particularly a guy called Kirk Sonson was doing a lot of great talks online and filled by a guy named Gordon McDowell. And then putting out all this information inspired a lot of people to go into this field, including me, and also including my co-founders. Yeah, so at the time I was studying, I was sort of looking at what were some interesting fields to come in early on and be part of laying the groundwork. And this just seemed like a ripe opportunity, I guess. I started thinking about how do I contribute to this and how could I possibly write my thesis in this work here. And around that time, people in Copenhagen were also starting to meet and talk about this technology. And I sort of caught wind of this and came to some of these meetings and talked to the people. And around this time, the company was founded. From early on, I was just very engaged in making sure that this is something that's going to happen and doing my part to sort of see that come to fruition.
How did you get wind of it? Was it meetup or some Facebook groups or?
Yeah, it was a meetup group actually on the website Meetup in Copenhagen. Just people interested in in thorium and molten salt reactors meeting up. So yeah, it's that's how I guess a nuclear company in Denmark can get started. It's just people meeting over beer and discussing the technology. And at that time, there were some companies that had already started, but it didn't seem like very much what's happening. And the interesting thing about molten salt reactors compared to some of the other technologies in nuclear and also even in fission or fusion, I mean, is that they sort of lend themselves to being developed by a small team or even a startup like ours, because the technology it's much smaller. It's basically metallic piping and a few components. There's besides a bunch of very complicated chemistry and some nuclear physics, it's not these giant machines, and there's no reason that you have to build them out of the most expensive materials known to man. So it's a very different kind of like development than a fusion reactor, a traditional fission reactor. And that sort of led us to look at, well, what is actually stopping this technology from being exploited? And it seemed like it was mostly just technical aspects, like actually developing the components and figuring out the supply chain and going and building these, because most of the basic science was studied in the 60s and 70s, and many of the basic questions were answered back then. So it was sort of this gold mine of like just go do it and figure out how to do it today, and maybe some of the things how to figure out how to do it in a smarter way.
Mm-hmm. And what was the first part then that you kind of developed? What are the first step that you took after funding the company?
Yeah, many companies in the nuclear industry sort of go the route of designing a full reactor and a feasibility study of all the components down to the steam turbine and even site planning. And our approach was more looking at all the components that would have to go in a reactor like this and not having any defined plan for how the final reactor is, like how each pipe is going to fit together, but more or less like how do we build all the systems that go together to build a complete design or a complete reactor, and knowing that along that way, along that journey, we were going to learn a lot of things of what works and what doesn't work. So it wouldn't even make sense to design a reactor early on, because it's going to change so many times along the route. So we sort of looking at, okay, what components can we buy, and more or less just let's try and build some simple test system without radioactive salts. And we sort of had the idea that at least from existing components, we would be able to buy a fair amount of the things, but it quickly became apparent that besides the steel piping, almost everything was not something that was industry used, because it's these high temperature salts that are not used. There's a little bit of use of salts of a different kind for thermal storage, but other than that, we basically had to develop all the components from scratch.
So you basically went the classic startup minimal viable product route instead of trying to come up with everything at once and then trying to get the regulations approved and everything.
Yeah, definitely. And that's still the journey we're on today. It's still the question of how do you make a minimal viable product in terms of a test reactor. So not putting in all the bells and whistles, but sort of figuring out all the minimal components that are needed to start one of these test reactors as a multiple reactor, and sort of adding on features further on.
And this was 6 years ago. So where does the money come from?
Yeah, in the beginning, it was a lot of the funding was from ourselves and from a few early investors, private investors. And early on, we also didn't use that many money because we were working for free, and we were building simple test systems and trying to figure out, like, how do we do salt treatment? How do we purify the salts? How do we, what kind of flanges do we want to use? Testing different valves. And we sort of, as we gained experience, we also got some Danish public grants and also more investors. But all the way up until today, it's basically private investors and a few public grants.
I mean, 6 years. 6 years is a very, very long time to go with close to no revenue, because I only saw recently that you started selling some of your reactors, or some of those test reactors, those 1 megawatt. Interesting enough, one of them on Amazon as well.
Yeah, so those are test systems and not reactors yet, at least. And this is sort of part of this developing the technology. It's you need a lot of testing, and each single component, also down to electronics and software, needs to be tested. And so we built these platforms where we can run pump tests and valve tests and heat exchanger tests. And these are the size of a Euro pallet. So they are not producing any energy, and they currently don't have any radioactive salts in them. But we then sell these to other, for example, research facilities that want to work with molten salts, or even some of the other companies that we collaborate with in this space to develop some of their components. And the idea here is sort of, it's not that we're in that much revenue from it, but more that we create collaboration relationships and partnerships in the industry. And so some of the technology that we have developed, others can benefit from, and then we can benefit from their developments on top of this platform.
Mm-hmm. So the idea is rather to help everyone achieve this massive goal of somehow getting rid of fossil fuels by just putting it out there.
Yeah, so we spent a fair amount of years getting this platform to the point where it is now. And we know that if other people started doing the same work now, they would basically have to go through the same development. And for a researcher that wants to study corrosion mechanisms, it doesn't really add any value that they spend years and a lot of grant money to develop their own loops. If they just want to study corrosion, then we can offer this loop and sort of be part of that study and sort of and maybe even influence what kind of materials are being looked at in these corrosion studies or other studies, whether it's a component, maybe we can buy that component further down the line. And it's a lot to do if every single startup that is looking to build these sort of reactors have to do everything by themselves. It's going to be a long journey, and we'd rather sort of see the whole field succeed and then work together in a field now where there's no reason really for competition, because there's no reactors online. Maybe there'll be a lot of competition in a few years' time when people start actually selling their reactors, but right now it's just a matter of building them and making them work.
Mm-hmm.
And the market is big enough for many players, of course, because we're talking about an industry that's currently coal, oil, and gas. So, yeah, it's not going to be a single company that has all that market.
No, probably not. So when you say you spent a good amount of years on that, where, what is the next plan for, let's say, next 5, 10, 20 years?
Yeah, so the current plan is to keep iterating on this testing platform to basically make it into a 1 megawatt demonstration reactor. And the reason we're going for a 1 megawatt demonstration reactor is that it's much more easy to get approval for a test reactor that doesn't produce any electricity than a commercial power reactor. And again, we also know from all our testing that things are going to break, and you're going to learn many things about your design that you wish to design another way. So all of these learning we can sort of put into a commercial reactor without having to go through the same expensive approval process. So we chose the path of building all these subsystems and components, and now we're in the process of sort of putting all that together to make a 1 megawatt demonstration reactor. And we plan to do that in about 5 years' time. And before we do that, we are now then currently constructing a prototype of this 1 megawatt demonstration reactor. And that's even before we try and put in nuclear fuel. We want to basically have all the components that goes into this 1 megawatt demonstration reactor and run that without radioactive salt to start with, and then further on with radioactive salt but without any fuel, and sort of see that everything works together. And even this is something that takes a fair amount of time. So this is something we plan to have done within the next 1.5 years, roughly. And that's just for taking all the technology we've developed now and then making sure that it all works together on a larger scale. And I should maybe say the size of this thing is roughly the size of a 40-foot shipping container. And that's the same size as commercial unit we've planned, which is 100 megawatt thermal molten salt reactor, where the reactor core is inside of a 40-foot sized containment vessel, 40-foot shipping container sized containment vessel.
Mm-hmm. Could I stand next to that thing?
No, not at all.
Okay.
Like you could stand next to it while it's being constructed, but while it's running, it would be, it would be very deadly.
Okay.
Same as any other reactor, or same for a fusion reactor or a like neutron spallation source. Mm-hmm. When you have this amount of radiation, it's you need a lot of shielding. Yeah, so it's not something you just drive in on a parking lot and start up.
Okay, I was just asking because I'm not sure who it was. Maybe Commonwealth Fusion that they were planning on having like their reactors in, I don't know how many years, in those normal lorries and just drive them around to places where they need them.
Yeah, again with the even fusion reactors. So while they're running, they also produce a lot of radiation. And they also activate the materials around the core of the fusion reactor. And so you might be able to drive them out to the site on a lorry. But as soon as you start them, you need shielding, or at least you need a fair amount of distance to the thing. And I wouldn't know their specific plans, but I would assume that you wouldn't be able to just drive that lorry through town afterwards either, simply because of the activation of the material inside.
So no Batman Begin.
No, yeah, there was actually built a fission reactor that fits on the back of the lorry, a military program from the 70s, I think. It's an American one where they built a small fission reactor that fits on back of a custom truck, more or less. And you could then drive this to a site and start it up. And it also had the power conversion system inside a Brayton cycle power conversion. So fairly cool little nuclear reactor, but I even think they had issues with shielding. And they basically just made a very large fence around it, and where you weren't like an exclusion zone where you're not allowed to go inside.
And then those 100 megawatts are, as far as I've heard, supposed to be in an assembly line, so you can just produce one after another to get them out.
Yeah. Again, the reason there is that if we want to have a technology that can scale to meet global energy demand, we need thousands of reactors.
Mm-hmm.
So current energy needs is like a little, like around 18 terawatts of energy. And so you can see if you're trying to replace that with nuclear, even if you make gigawatt size reactors, you still need thousands of them.
Yep.
And we're planning to make 100 megawatt thermal reactors. So we need many thousands of these reactors. And of course, many of them can be placed on the same site. So if you have some place that can consume a lot of energy, you can also place many of these reactors in a row. It's just that it's very beneficial to have a technology that you can develop in a factory rather than on site.
Yep.
That you can ship out and turn on at the site, but that you can construct in an assembly line fashion, because we know that that's how, from many other technologies, that's how we get the cost down.
Mm-hmm. If I were now completely obsessed with this topic and would want to know more, is there any reasonably easy introduction to everything, or only papers, and where would I need to look for that?
That's a good question. It is a very complicated subject, and there's a lot of both technology and history and many aspects that sort of make this the perfect storm of a technology. But well, hopefully this podcast can serve as an early start for some people. But I would probably suggest to go on YouTube and look at some of the mini talks that are they're on there, and yeah, follow along the field. There isn't any good course that I'm aware of, and I only think this is something that's just now being started to be taught at universities. So it is something fairly new, and where you can still get in early and be part of this technology development.
I would have one more question, a bit more personal.
That's fine.
You're the youngest one of all of them. Is there any, particularly in the beginning, any issue with imposter along the line?
No, I wouldn't think so. It's, of course, being younger among a group of older founders is, of course, very beneficial from my point of view, because that comes with a lot of experience from their point of view. So we started as a group of engineers and scientists, both in my background is in physics, but also in mechanics and in chemistry and software. So it was a very diverse group of people. We basically together had all the skills sort of to build this technology, at least in an early stage. Now we are, of course, at a point where we need many more people and many more skills that we don't have to both build technology parts and components that we haven't done already, but also to scale the business and the team. But it is kind of a crazy thing to start a company creating nuclear reactors in Denmark. And so, of course, I wouldn't say so much imposter syndrome, but just like, are we even allowed to do this kind of syndrome? But of course, it's like very exciting and thrilling to be able to develop a technology. Of course, the base was sort of laid in the 60s and 70s, but to be part of a completely new technology that has the potential to change like humanity's history, because every time we unlocked a new energy source that had orders of magnitude more abundance of energy, human existence also changed proportionally. So it's very exciting to sort of see what kind of technologies can come from this, because the first step is sort of just making a new level of energy available for the world. But the exciting part is almost what would that allow in terms of manufacturing and new technologies and space exploration and yeah, all the other things that follow from abundance of energy.
No.
And we've been running on oil for over 100 years now, but what's sort of the future going to bring?
Thank you very much for joining, and hopefully see you soon once we're allowed to leave the house again.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me, and you're of course welcome to come visit us here in Copenhagen when travel is allowed again.
Hi, Philip here. Before you leave, I just wanted to thank you for listening, and I hope you learned something in this episode. If that is the case, why not message me at philip@deeptechstories.io. I'm always curious about what you took away and look forward to a discussion with you. That is philipp@deeptechstories.io. It would also help me out a great deal if you could recommend the episode to a friend of yours that might find it interesting as well.